Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to be talking about tomatoes, the love apple here, the love fruit here to begin the show. They have a long and interesting history, and we're going to be taking a closer look at them with our guest, John Honig, with us. He lectures in history at Penn State University, also teaches history at Texas Women's University in Denton, Texas. And we'll talk with him about his book, Garden Variety, the American Tomato from Corporate to Heirloom. So, how important are tomatoes in your cooking, in your life? What is it about tomatoes that appeals to you? Join our conversation. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234 and send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, or you can reach us through Twitter at the Larry Mueller Show. So we'd certainly love to hear from you. John Honig, welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You know, if I want to get something out of the way right off the bat here. If I was in a horticulture class and they gave me an exam and they asked in the exam, is a tomato a fruit or a vegetable? I would grit my teeth and I would say it's a fruit, even though I and 99.9% of all Americans think of it as a vegetable. And you write about it as a vegetable in your book.
I do. I mean, botanically, it's certainly a fruit, as are a lot of the vegetables that we eat. We certainly, as a culture, have treated it as a vegetable. The Supreme Court determined that it was a vegetable for taxation purposes. Surprise, surprise. I generally refer to it as a vegetable because, frankly, I'm not a scientist, and I'm not, I'm not, you know, the book isn't really about botany, so.
No, it's not.
So that's how I refer to it as.
And I'm glad you did. As a matter of fact, you're a historian, and, you know, I'm thinking of, if I'm a historian and I'm thinking about what am I going to research, probably the tomato wouldn't have been the first thing in my mind. Why did you decide to write a book about tomatoes?
Well, I'll try to give you the short version of that story. I became interested in food. I wasn't initially interested in food. I'm sort of trained in consumer culture and environmental history, and so food kind of, you know, comes naturally.
Sure.
When you start thinking about that. And basically, I started looking for something that would tell me a different story than that which we normally read when we read about food. And you start looking at foods, a lot of the work that's been done, both academic and popular, has been done on things like meat, things like grain, and not as much about vegetables. And I think it tells us a different story about the industrialization of food. I do happen to like tomatoes, which is obviously also a good thing. Otherwise, I probably would have lost my sanity somewhere along the way. I figured out very early on that I think you could tell a slightly different story than that which is usually told.
Yeah, it's an interesting story for sure. And you did a lot of research on the history of the tomato and used a passel of sources for it.
Yeah, that part of it was a struggle. I mean, fortunately, we live in the age of the internet where some of this stuff amazingly has been digitized by Google and things like that. But I went around all over the country because it might surprise you, there's not a single library that wants to be the stockpile of all tomato-related sources, which is unfortunate when you're on a budget, but it made for some adventures anyway.
Yeah, where did the tomatoes originate? Tell us about that.
Well, it starts in South America, sort of in the Andes, and basically, whether intentionally or unintentionally, the tomato moves through human contact up into Mexico, and that's where the Spanish found it when they make it to the New World. And from there, it's taken to the Caribbean and back to Europe, and it really doesn't make its way into the present-day United States until quite a bit later, and it comes from the Caribbean.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that the tomato hasn't been here the whole time we've been around. It started started somewhere else, went to Europe, went to the Caribbean, and now we have it. Why did it take so long? It took a fair amount of time to get it here and to get for it to become popular.
Sure. I mean, I think I'm not sure if I have a great answer for why it didn't get here sooner. Other than, you know, obviously it's taken by the Spanish, and so it, you know, it didn't have as easy of a time getting to the United States as it wasn't a Spanish colony. But in terms of, you know, why was it essentially not eaten earlier than we would have liked, perhaps? You know, it does get here before 1800, and by 1800 it is spread to most areas. But it still wasn't eaten, you know, daily, or certainly not at the levels that we eat it today. And traditionally people have sort of said, oh, well, you know, either it's because it wasn't here, which we know now is not true, or because everyone assumed it to be poisonous. And that's not really a particularly compelling argument either. There certainly were people who thought that that the tomato was poisonous. I mean, but just like there's people today who, you know, have sort of crazy dietary ideas as well. But we do know that they were being consumed. But I would argue that a large part of the problem was that the tomato didn't fit into the American diet yet. And whenever new foods are introduced, it takes, you know, generations for them to be really integrated into the American diet. And, you know, in the case of America, when colonists first came over, they really tried to replicate European diets in America. And when they adopted new foods, it was often out of necessity. And so, you know, there was a sort of a streak of conservatism when it came to adopting new foods. But another big obstacle here is that the tomato is highly seasonal, and nowadays we've created varieties that grow very quickly. But even then, you're in Wisconsin. You know, how long is the tomato season in Wisconsin? It's not especially long.
No.
And it tends to come at a time when a lot of other foods are, you know, going to be harvested. And so when you already have sort of a stock of different foods that you grow and that are harvested at that particular time of the year, you know, why adopt new ones?
Yeah.
It's going to make your work harder. You know, you're going to have more to do during that time. You're going to have to eat all of those tomatoes before they go bad. And so I argue anyway that that was actually one of the biggest obstacles to the tomato being really heavily integrated into the American diet.
And, you know, way back in the day with the kind of way people grew up, as you say, the European tradition, you had vegetables, you had squash and, you know, rutabaga and things like that that would store well.
Absolutely. And the tomato wasn't that.
And so you could see why people weren't going to waste a lot of their effort growing something that they couldn't, you know, keep around for a long time.
Sure.
Yeah.
And once preservation methods were figured out, you know, consumption explodes.
We're talking today with John Honig. He is the a historian and the author of The American Tomato, Garden Variety from Corporate to Heirloom. Looking for your comments or suggestions and experiences as well. What do you think about the tomato? What's your favorite one? What great experiences do you have with tomatoes? Give a call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Twitter, The Larry Mueller Show. Certainly love to hear from you. So the tomatoes have an interesting history, I think, because they are a little different, actually quite a bit different from some of the other foods that had a kind of a corporate, have become corporatized, I guess you might say, wheat and corn and so forth.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's really what drew me to the topic to begin with. That's sort of the first thing that I was sort of looking at. But when you talk about the, say, the meat industry, you know, in the late 19th century, it's heavily concentrated in Chicago. Obviously, people are raising cattle elsewhere, but they're, you know, they're being shipped to Chicago, they're being slaughtered, packaged, so on. And, you know, in Chicago, there's a handful of slaughterhouses that that essentially come to process the vast majority of beef, anyway, in the country. And you look at grain, and again, Chicago becomes the hub for all of this grain that's being grown, and it's essentially treated as a almost as a form of currency. I mean, that's where you get the development of the futures market, where you're buying this. You're not buying any specific grain. You're buying a particular, or you're buying a sort of generic concept of grain that you can then get later at, you know, that isn't the same grain that you bought. I'm not explaining that well. But so you get a heavy concentration, and the tomato industry, actually the opposite happens during the same time period. Essentially, in the early 20th century, you basically have a tomato industry that's relatively heavily centered in places like New Jersey and sort of in the Mid-Atlantic, with some production in sort of the Midwest and Indiana and Ohio. But you actually see that spreading out all over the country during the early 20th century, to the Midwest, to Florida, to Texas, to places like Mississippi and Tennessee, as well as California. So almost every region of the country is growing tomatoes to be sold on at market. And what I've found is that a big reason for that is that essentially people would carve out, you know, say Gibson County, Tennessee, would carve out a particular time of the year when they could ship tomatoes to urban markets in the north and elsewhere, where other places couldn't. And so the seasonality of the tomato actually sort of helped decentralize production and ensured sort of better access to a year-round supply of tomatoes.
It's an interesting story. Our guest, John Honig, today, author of the book The American Tomato, Garden Variety, From Corporate to Heirloom. Again, join in, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Twitter page, The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, here on the Ideas Network. John Honig, our guest today, as we talk about the American tomato. At 11:45, we'll switch from tomatoes to owls and talk about the International Owl Center and an event that's going on there. Right now, though, we're zeroing in on the history of the American tomato. You can join us at 800-642-1234. We'd love to hear from you. John, you say in your book, and you kind of talk about this, we've already talked a little about this, the tomato production had really two distinct time frames. And I'm trying to remember here. It was 1880 to through about 1945, thereabouts, and then 45 through the 70s. Talk about that a little bit more, what went on in those periods.
Yeah. So the first period, and I think that's the time period I more or less identify, is sort of what I was just talking about.
Yep.
Where we get a heavily decentralized tomato industry, and then one thing to add to that, in addition to decentralization being fueled by seasonality, you also get the rise of very inexpensive canning equipment. Which allowed canneries to open up all over the place. You know, you could get one started for several hundred dollars, which, is a lot more than a couple hundred dollars today, but it's nonetheless something that many farmers were actually encouraged to, buy some of this canning equipment, and you could can the leftover crop. You know, you don't have to sell it for virtually nothing, because, a big part of tomato farming back in those days anyway is that the earliest tomatoes that you produced sold for a lot more than any of the other tomatoes. And sometimes, often, by the end of the season, you're simply throwing them away.
Or
even not picking them because it's costing you more to pick them than you can sell them for, because, of course, everyone's tomatoes are on the market. So this would give an opportunity to farmers to actually be able to make some money off of the leftover crop. But so during the first half of the century, you see this decentralization. And so identify that as pretty starkly different from what's going on in most areas of the food industry. Now, in the second half of the century, that you see a sort of second wave of industrialization in terms of the tomato, and that is when you could say that the tomato starts to look a lot more like some of these other industries, and it's fueled by a couple different things. By the end of the first period, so say in the beginning in the late 20s and especially in the 30s in World War II, you do start to see increasingly tomato production start to move towards Florida and California. So you do start to see that trend earlier. But what really solidifies it is two things. One is that our food culture is starting to change, and we're starting to eat a lot more heavily processed food. So instead of buying canned whole tomatoes like you might have in the early 20th century, you're buying canned spaghetti, or you're buying frozen pizzas or something like that. So one part of it is change in consumption. The other part of it is the creation of the tomato harvester. This was only particularly useful for tomato production for canneries, right? Because it would kind of beat up the tomatoes enough to where you wouldn't want to sell them as fresh tomatoes. But this comes out of research done at University of California, and it takes place over more than a decade, if I'm remembering correctly. The harvester really helps solidify the place of a can house tomato production in California. It requires large acreage to be able to make sense of it, right? You've got to have a bunch of acres to make use of this new expensive equipment. And a lot of the tomato-producing states, the folks that were growing tomatoes simply weren't growing large acreages. It also requires a dry environment. If the fields are wet, the harvester can't run, and then you lose your tomato. At least in the area in California where they're grown, they do often have to be irrigated, watered by, human hands. So this allowed California farmers to really take advantage of this technology and really help move tomato production to the West Coast.
Interesting. Larry in Oshkosh has something for us. Let's go to him now. Larry, hi. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Yes, I heard you talking about preserving tomatoes. That's always been a hassle. We used to boil them and freeze them. We used to can them. But we're baking them now as they come in, and throw some onions or garlic or other seasonings in, and then freeze it. It's ready to go for chilies or dishes. It's been a game changer for us now.
Thanks for calling. And that kind of goes along with how we think about the tomato, doesn't it, really? John?
Certainly the way that we think about the tomato now, I think it actually speaks a lot to the way that we preserve tomatoes, the way that we have changed our thoughts about how to preserve tomatoes. Initially, when you were trying to preserve a tomato, There are a couple of different ways of doing it, but your general idea was to preserve it as sort of unprocessed as possible, or as sort of raw, I guess you could say, sort of as possible. So people would actually try to essentially put a tomato in salt water and brine, with the hopes of when they decide to eat it, they could take it out and rinse it off, and it would be as fresh as possible, or it would emulate freshness as much as possible. But certainly, over time, what we've done is we've also mixed it with other things. So I think your caller said he mixed it with baked them with onions and garlic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very much something that we would do now. That with the exception of, like, say, ketchups, which was a very early form of preserving tomatoes, people would generally try to avoid. You know, they wanted to maximize their ability to do something with it once they had decided to eat it, not before when they were preserving it.
I tell you what, Heinz and Campbell's have made a lot of money on tomatoes.
Yeah, they absolutely have, and they really kind of start this trend towards making it more than just a tomato, right? So
yeah.
Obviously ketchup has other ingredients in it. But I think Campbell's in particular is an interesting story because at the time, when you talked about canned tomatoes, for example, in the early 20th century, you were almost exclusively talking about, like, canned whole tomatoes. So, you know, you can still buy those in the store, but most people don't, right? They go straight to the sauces or whatever. But in an age where brand name goods were starting to become necessary in a national market, Campbell's decides, you know what, we need to start making soups. And, you know, soups are a value-added product, right? They're not just, we can make a brand out of that. It's hard to make a brand out of canned whole tomatoes, you know.
Yeah.
I go straight for the generic brand. But when it's soup, you can say, well, look, we're doing this better. And that's what Campbell's did, and certainly Heinz was doing this to some extent as well. But you know, it's this sort of innovation in the marketplace that really helped Campbell succeed.
A value-added product is what the marketers would call it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Larry, thanks again. Alice in Fitchburg, your turn. Hi, Alice. Thanks for calling.
Well, hi. Thank you. I have a question. I came up in a mixed family. My mother always put salt and pepper on tomatoes, and my dad always put sugar on. Where does that come from?
That's, there any history connected with that you know about, Jeff?
I mean, yes and no. I don't know the specific origins of either of those exactly, but certainly in the mid-19th century, you would see, I mean, there's so many recipes that people are trying to, you know, people are essentially trying to figure out what to do with the tomato. And certainly when people start eating fresh tomatoes, you see salt and pepper or something like that quite often. You don't really see sugar in the recipes as much, but you do see tomatoes being used sort of experimentally as a substitute for peaches and other fruits in certain dishes. You see tomato aspic, so gelatin, like basically jello, being used. So you do see the tomato being used in sort of a sweet way on occasion as well. And I suspect its roots, you know, sort of somewhere in there. But it's, you know, it was essentially cooks experimenting and trying to figure out, well, what will work. You know, they hadn't seen this food item before, and so it took a lot of experimentation. I mean, they started making wine out of tomatoes, you know, and that didn't stick for very long. I've never had tomato wine, but I can imagine it might not be great. But so there was a lot of experimentation, and there's a lot of successes and probably a lot more failures.
I'm thinking about tomatoes and sugar, and I'm thinking about ketchup, where you find about a cup of sugar in a big bottle of ketchup.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, it's funny. I don't really understand like the chemistry of food. I tried to take a little online class on it one time, trying to figure it out, but I couldn't do the chemical equations or whatever to do it all. But the way that how that much salt and sugar, you know, is used to sort of balance each other out, never quite understood the sort of chemistry behind that. But yeah, I mean, you look at ketchup, and even the old ketchups had tons of sugar and tons of salt in it.
Yeah.
So that wasn't an invention of corporate America by any stretch.
Alice, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Kate in Wisconsin Rapids a chance to join us. Kate, hello. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I grew up in New Jersey and had an Italian dad who grew up there, and my mom also grew up there in New Jersey, which he had mentioned earlier. Has been known, and I grew up hearing it from my parents, that New Jersey had the best tomatoes in the whole country, along with the best sweet corn. The tomatoes, I must admit, I think were the best, and I did read not long ago that Rutgers University is actually trying to get genetically some of the old heirloom ones that grew originally in New Jersey going again. And I wondered if you could enlighten me on whether he also had heard that New Jersey had a reputation for the best tomatoes.
Oh, sure.
That came from.
Yeah. John?
Oh, yeah. Anybody in the Mid-Atlantic, I mean, the entire time I lived in Pennsylvania, everyone always talked about the New Jersey tomatoes. Now that I'm back in Texas, everyone tells me how great Texas tomatoes are. So I think to some extent, everywhere you go, those tomatoes are the best. But certainly, there is a history of New Jersey allegedly having the best tomatoes, and it actually kind of tells an interesting story about the way that tomato production changed in the early 20th century, because what ends up happening is New Jersey is growing lots and lots of tomatoes. They're sending them to urban markets. People are buying them. They're loving them. The problem is you can't get New Jersey tomatoes but for a couple months a year. And so what happens, what sort of drives this growth in southern tomatoes in particular is the desire to sort of grow tomatoes during this other time of the year. And that's what they're doing. And they're pretty low-quality tomatoes. I mean, they're often being picked green. They're shipped to New York City or Philadelphia or wherever. And then they're put into a room and gassed to make them appear ripe. They turn red, but they're mealy, they're hard, they're not great tomatoes. But the problem, of course, is that they are there when no other tomatoes are. And so tomatoes themselves started to get a bad reputation through parts of the early 20th century because of low quality. And a lot of it was because in the early parts of the year, there are, you know, tons of not very good tomatoes. And by the time the New Jersey tomatoes hit the market, this story goes anyway, everyone was kind of tomatoed out for the year. And so the industry in New Jersey started suffering for it.
And which is why they could say, boy, our tomatoes taste a whole heck of a lot better than those tomatoes.
Wow, that's great.
Thanks, Kate. Appreciate the call. Roger in Madison, your turn. Hi, Roger.
Hello. I heard a great tomato story on Wisconsin Public Radio probably 20-plus years ago. Hugh Iltis, the well-known agronomist from the University of Wisconsin, told a story of riding. He was riding horseback with a friend of his somewhere in South America. They were I can't remember a lot of details, but he as they were riding along, they stopped, and for a minute he looked he was looking around at the plant life, and saw a little red a little tiny red berry growing on the ground, and thought to himself, geez, that looks like it could be a little wild tomato, and picked it and and popped it into his mouth, and it was the sweetest little tomato that he'd ever tasted. And so he rummaged around and found a few more of those plants and collected seeds and sent them to an agronomist friend of his in California. Thought he might be interested. Just dropped them in an envelope and mailed them. And heard back from the agronomist in California that tomato, that little wild tomato, had been hybridized into California tomatoes and had increased the value of the California tomato crop by millions and millions of dollars.
Yeah. I think you told that story on my show. As I remember, Hugh Iltis was a great horticulturist and a regular contributor to the show, and had many achievements when it came to not only tomatoes but others as well. And I don't know if his name ever came up, John, in your research or not.
I didn't catch his name. Who?
Hugh Iltis, I-L-T-I-S.
No, I didn't. I've never noticed that particular name. Although it actually reminds me very much of. This story could have belonged to a couple other folks when developing the tomato harvester. Now, I want to say before I say that, a wild tomato looks very much like exactly what your caller describes. They're not big, and they're usually not especially pretty. They could very well look like a berry, and they certainly obviously have been adapted over time to create different varieties to be larger and so on and so forth. But what actually happens when they develop the tomato harvester, they have to develop a new tomato at the same time. The way a harvester works, essentially, is it pulls the plant out of the ground, cuts it off, picks it up, and then shakes it into the truck, basically, to get the tomatoes to fall off. And then it goes through the whole process. In order for that to work effectively, you need a tomato, one, that ripens at the same time, right? You need your tomatoes to be ripe when it's picked, as opposed to, you know, how you do it at home. You see a ripe tomato, you grab it, and you get the next one the next day. You also need a tomato that won't fall off the vine when the machine is taking the plant out of the ground, but will fall off when it is shaken over the truck. And there's a whole list of things, that qualities that needed to be bred into tomatoes in order for that to happen. And the way a lot of the genetic material that was used to help do that actually did come from South America and from agricultural scientists, you know, going down to South America, collecting examples. There's one example, or specimens. There's one example of one of these UC Davis scientists being down there, and they had found some tomato seeds, but they couldn't get them to germinate. So they couldn't grow them, and you know, they finally figured out that they had to wait for, I can't remember what kind of animal it was, but basically the animal had to eat the tomato and, you know,
poop it out
until it came out the other side before they would actually germinate. Some part of that, you know, animal's stomach, you know, basically create, you know, made the seed plantable. And it took them a long time to figure out. There's a lot of sort of trial and error. But it sounds like a very similar story to that. And a lot of those qualities that came from South America and these wild tomatoes that they found did get bred into tomatoes for harvesting, for mechanical harvesting.
Yeah. Thanks again for that call. Bob in Monroe, thank you for calling.
Hey, I just had a quick question here. I had heard that if you take a tomato, an organic one and a non-organic one, and you look at the nutritional value of the organic one, it's going to be significantly higher than the non-organic tomato. Is there any truth to that?
That may be too far afield for you, John.
Yeah, I don't. I do talk about sort of organic and genetically modified stuff a little bit in the book, but not in terms of like the science behind it or the nutritional value. I honestly, I don't keep up with those debates. Those debates get too much yelling for me.
All right, can't help you out with that one, Bob. Thanks for calling. Well, Angie emailed a quote from Miles Kington, I think. Knowledge is knowing that a tomato is a fruit. Wisdom is not putting it in a fruit salad.
Yeah, someone got me a magnet that I have on my refrigerator that says that.
Yeah, and I was thinking about your book, and actually tomatoes got one of the reasons for its popularity was a time period when we were kind of going away a little bit from meat and we could use tomatoes in salad, if I'm not mistaken.
I'm sorry, I missed the second half of that.
Oh, the people were going away from meat a bit, and so tomatoes were seen as a good substitute, a good thing to put in a salad.
Yeah, the rise of salads in the United States, perhaps not surprisingly, comes at a time when people are becoming more interested in health. And it happens in the early 20th century, right around the time that they're discovering vitamins. So now, you know, fruits and vegetables that previously were just thought of as things that make things taste better are now seen as, you know, an important part of the diet. And meat, which traditionally you counted calories essentially, and you wanted lots of protein. So meat was always the sort of end all be all. But once you start figuring out that vitamins matter, you start to see salads and certainly tomatoes become an integral part of that.
Do you have a favorite tomato variety? Tom emailed to ask for a recommendation for a good heirloom tomato and wondered if Brandywine is a good one.
Brandywine is a good one. In terms of growing, I think the one I've had the most luck with lately is called the Mortgage Lifter. I haven't had great success with these, but there was a guy named Alexander Livingston who created a bunch of tomato varieties in the late 19th century, and his varieties were kind of the gold standard during that time. And I've tried to grow. I've only found maybe one or two. I think I found Livingston's Paragon, and I can't remember what the other one is that I have found. But there's a dozen or so, but I think I've only seen two or three available. But I always liked the idea of growing some of those.
John, you have a fascinating book, and it was great fun talking with you today about it. Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Well, thanks for having me, and thanks to the guests for calling in.
Yeah, John Honig, lecturer in history at Penn State University. He also teaches at Texas Women's University in Denton, Texas, as well, and is the author of the book we've been talking about, The American Tomato, Garden Variety, From Corporate to Heirloom. John Honig, the author. That was a lot of fun, and I learned an awful lot. We didn't get to everything for sure. There's a lot more in the book that we didn't get to. And that's always the way, but we move on to other topics. And you know what? We're going to go from tomatoes to owls. What about that? We've got the executive director of the International Owl Center from Houston, Minnesota, up next.